Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, what's the story, Morning Glory? What's the word, Hummingbird? I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Polkabon.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today...
Yes, Joe.
We're going to talk about 5G.
5G?
It's 1G more.
It is 1G more than
4G.
Something.
Yeah.
Oh, it probably would be 4G. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I remember back in the old days of when I was first getting into cell phones.
Okay.
And, you know, getting into them. Like, I was, like, getting into baseball cards or something.
Sure.
Back when I think I had my first cell phone, I remember hearing about 3G.
Yeah.
And it was the heyday of 3G, when 3G was a great thing, and I had no idea what that meant.
Well, you were not alone, Joe.
But... Recently, I saw an interesting... This was yet another topic I came across because of something I saw in Alexis Madrigal's awesome email, his Real Future email newsletter, which if you're not subscribed to that, you should. It's amazing.
Yeah?
Yeah, but it's about 5G.
Oh, okay.
No, not the newsletter, the topic that we want to talk about today.
Right, right. So we have a lot of ground to cover before we can get to 5G, right?
4G's worth of material, at least.
That's
yeah.
right.
Okay. So, so all of this G business, has to do, well, okay. So G stands for generation. Let's get that out there.
Right.
At the top. And, and what generation of stuff we're talking about has to do with, at its base level, how radio frequencies are allotted for broadcast and communication.
Yeah.
All right. Because that is how your cell phone works. It transmits data back and forth to cellular towers via radio waves.
As does a lot of other stuff.
Right. And so bits of the radio spectrum are cordoned off for all of these different uses, mm-hmm. for television and for flight navigation and for mobile data and for local data within your house and et cetera and et cetera. And of course, when organizations and governments started allocating these frequencies, no one could have predicted the crush of mobile data, the demand or the supply.
Mm-hmm.
And no one could have predicted the speed with which technology would be developed to attempt to meet that demand. It's all been really pretty haphazard.
Right. So this is going to make it even weirder when we're trying to predict what the next generation is going to look like. But there is something... maybe interesting to say about it, but I think before we get there, we need to do a sort of brief history of the G's in plain
right.
English.
And Lauren, to your point, I mean, keep in mind, like this entire technology is just over a century old. I mean, from the point of using radio waves.
Radio, we mean, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, not cellular phones, that's much younger, but the radio in general, we've been using that for a little more than 100 years, and... obviously, when it was first being used, there were no regulations because it hadn't been a thing before, right?
Yeah, everyone was just like, "Wee!"
So the regulations that came in place, they were developed in different parts of the world. So allocations you will find in the United States are not necessarily the same as you would find in Europe, which may not be the same as you would find in other parts of the world. So that also makes things a little more complicated because, if the whole world were working on one standard, this story would probably be a lot easier. But that's not the way things turned out. So let's start with the first generation, the original series, the Captain Kirk of the cellular world. That first generation was an analog cellular system, not digital.
This is 1G.
1G, yeah.
They probably didn't call it that at the time.
No. It's like you wouldn't say first annual. That's just dumb.
No, people do say that.
Well, they shouldn't. Anyway, unless they're of course talking about the second time they've held the event, that could be the first annual one. At any rate, so 1G stood for technologies including NMT, CNETs, AMPS, and TACS, or AMPS and TACS, which all began in the 1980s. They had very limited bandwidth, so they really were only suitable for voice transmission. You did get a few, radio modem type things, but they were extremely limited in what they could do. So this was really primarily for voice transmission, and that was it. These would be the old cellular phones that you would remember if you're old enough, with the big brick cellular phones, the giant ones with a huge antenna.
Yeah.
That's this era we're talking about. Then you get to 2G. This is when we start moving into the 1990s. And this is where the two really big competing technologies came out of, GSM and CDMA. Specifically CDMA-1. There was also D-Amps at this time, but this is when we get into the first generation of digital cellular systems. So it's the second generation of cell systems overall, but the first generation of digital systems.
Okay, you're saying a lot of acronyms. What are all these about? So tell me about amps and GSM.
I'll tell you about GSM and CDMA, because those are the two really important ones.
Okay.
GSM stands for Global System for Mobiles, and CDMA stands for Code Division Multiple Access. Both of these are technologies that allow for multiple access to a tower to allow for transmission of radio signals. Very important, very basic technology that allows cell phones to work. Obviously, for a cell phone to work, you need to be able to access a tower so that you can send your transmission to the tower to go onto the network and then receive information back from the network. And you need a methodology for handshakes. That's the time where you are going between one tower and another. Like you're starting to leave one tower's transmission area while you're entering another one, and there's a handshake.
Hi, here I am.
Yeah, that allows that to continue without any interruption. So that way, if Lauren and I are talking on a cell phone and she's driving, and she goes past one tower to another, there's not an interruption in the conversation. So both of these technologies could do that. They were both the basics for digital cell phones. However, they're competing technologies. GSM phones won't work on a CDMA system and vice versa. You can get world phones. Like if you have a CDMA phone, you can get a world phone where it also has a GSM chip in it, but it'll still primarily work on a CDMA network. Now, the reason why I call it world phones is that most of the world, the overwhelming population of the world, relies on GSM. The United States is one of the few places that also has CDMA. So we have two major carriers that use GSM. That would be AT&T and T-Mobile. And then we have two major carriers, maybe three if you include some of the other slightly smaller but growing ones, but two major ones in Verizon and Sprint that use CDMA technology. And this is a problem, obviously, because it means that if you have a CDMA phone, you are more limited in where you can take that phone and actually use it, unless, again, you have a world phone. Most people end up either having a travel phone where it's a GSM phone just for travel, or, you know, you can invest in a world phone. And maybe one day this will become moot, but for now it's still a thing. So the reason why most of the world uses GSM instead of CDMA is that in 1987, European governments mandated it. They said you have to use GSM. And they were specifically looking at that because they considered it an industry consortium that had produced the GSM standard. In other words, it was a partnership among several different companies. No one company laid claim to ownership of it. That was not true with CDMA, which was, you know, kind of a Qualcomm thing. So they thought GSM better than this privately owned standard. The United States, however, looked at it as saying, hey, CDMA is allowing for faster data and voice transmission rates, clearer phone calls, you know, that a better experience earlier on. And that's why in the United States, you had some carriers pushing CDMA. Now, GSM caught up, but it took some time. So at first, CDMA was in the lead, and then the two were more or less comparable. Now, if you have a GSM phone, it's very easy to switch from one network to another. So if I have an AT&T phone and I want to switch to T-Mobile, it's very easy to do. I go to T-Mobile, I get a new SIM card, and I just pop it into my phone, and it should work fine. And the other nice thing is, if I want to switch phones within the same network, it's easy. So let's say I've got my Nexus 4 on T-Mobile, and I want to upgrade to a Nexus 6, then I can get the new phone, pop the SIM card into my new phone, and it works right out of the box. Like, it's perfect. I don't have to do anything else to it. That is, of course, assuming that the SIM card is the same size for the two phones, because recently we've received a lot of new types of SIM card technology where they've been getting smaller and smaller. So sometimes you still have to go to a phone like carrier store in order to get a new size. Or if you have a very steady hand, you can cut one down yourself. I didn't trust myself, so I went to the store to get one. So the other thing about early GSM and CDMA was that CDMA could not handle simultaneous voice and data. So you might remember commercials. I think AT&T ran commercials about how specifically with the iPhone, you could have both voice and data at the same time, because at one time, AT&T in the United States was the only carrier that had the iPhone. It's no longer the case, mm-hmm. but for several years, that was the case. And they said, hey, you can use both on our phone, because it happened to be a GSM phone. They didn't, you know, it sounded like they were saying that it was unique to the iPhone. It wasn't. It was that.
It was the network.
The technology capacity they were using allowed for it. So that is your 2G. You'd think we would immediately go to 3G, but hold up a second, because there's 2.5G.
This is starting to sound like seasons of the new Battlestar Galactica.
It feels like that. It also feels like generations of the iPhone, where the number that is associated with the iPhone is not necessarily the actual generation of the iPhone.
Or Windows. Like, this is Windows
10. We went from Windows 7 to Windows 8 to Windows 10.
Schmickery-doo. So
when can I
love Windows schmickery-doo.
When can I get cell phone ME?
All right, well, let's go back to 2.5G.
Okay, yeah.
So this is where we get even more confusing. All right,
oh,
so
no.
We've got these two competing technologies that, you know, in the GMS and CDMA. Now we get to GPRS and CDMA 2001X. These were enhanced 2G networks. So here's the deal. We're not just talking about generations here. It would be so much easier if we were talking generations, except for the fact that since we have a branching technology tree, you would have different generations as technologies mature at different rates, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So GSM would be maturing at one, and I think I said GMS a second ago, but GSM would be maturing at one rate, and CDMA would be maturing at another rate. So that would make that confusing. But to try and make it a little more streamlined, the various international organizations have come in to say, listen, we're going to say that generation stands for the capability of your technology, not how many iterations there have been, but there is a bare basic limit of how much data they have to be able to accept per second. And if they meet that, that means they fall into this generation versus that generation.
Oh,
okay.
That's nice.
Yeah, so 2.5 is 2.5 because it's faster than 2, but it doesn't quite meet the standards that were set for 3G. So they had to think, where do you put them? You don't want to call it 2G because as a carrier, you want to use this as a selling point to your customers, saying our networks are faster than 2G. But you can't go and say they're 3G because the data rates aren't there yet.
They could have just gone with like awesome 2 or sucky 3.
Yeah, 2G plus or 2G plus or 3G minus a little bit. So that gets us to 3G, where we have a whole bunch of different competing standards, which I'm not even going to go into. I mean, Edge is in there. So if you've ever heard about being on the Edge network, that's technically a 3G network. They have even faster data rates than previous generations at about 384 kilobits per second. So when I say even faster, that's pretty slow. Yeah, but faster than 2G. So the UN International Telecommunications Union set the standard for 3G at 2 megabits per second if the phone is stationary, and 384 kilobits per second for a phone that's in motion. Obviously, phones that are in motion have to deal with this handshake, so that's what complicates matters. If you are stationary, you don't need to do that, and you can have a faster download rate.
Okay, so we're getting closer to the present day.
Yeah.
When we hit 4G.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Tell me the story of 4G.
4G is another complicated story.
Sing to me the epic of 4G.
So I can tell you what 4G is supposed to be.
Okay.
4G is supposed to be 1 gigabit per second when the phone is stationary or mobile device. It's not just a phone now. Mm-hmm. But 4G, you should be able to get a 1 gigabit per second download rate when when the device is not in motion, and 100 megabits per second when it is in motion. However, none of the current standards that are touted as being 4G meet that specification.
What?
Huh. Yeah.
So they're just flipping the UN off all the time?
Yeah, they're essentially saying, listen, we're calling this 4G because it is the next generation of our technology. It works in a completely different way from 3G. It uses a different methodology for handling data. It's using brand new technology, so we got to call it something. We're not calling it 3G plus or 3.5G, so we're calling it 4G, and you can take your standards and just pretend like they don't exist, because wow, that's what we're going to do.
That's like if Star Trek The Next Generation had James Doohan in the engineering room.
Yeah. So We're just having him. No reason. We're not explaining it. So we have this 4G name that's a marketing term. It's not really, they're not 4G according to those UN standards, which, by the way, even the UN now is like, whatever. Okay, fine.
And the technologies that we're talking about that are called 4G are LTE, and then
there's WiMAX and there's HSPA Plus. HSPA Plus comes in a couple different flavors, 14, 21, and 42, although 21 and 42 are the ones that are considered to be closer to 4G speeds. None of these get close to that 1 gigabit per second. LTE tops out at around 100 megabits per second or so. You can get the fastest speed I've seen for LTE is 300 megabits per second. That was like an ideal test. There is LTE Advanced, which could theoretically get much faster, but that's not rolled out very widely right now. WiMAX is kind of dead in the water, essentially. It's no longer really a thing. Everyone's looking at LTE. HSPA Plus, some carriers use that. T-Mobile uses that, but they also use LTE. They roll out LTE networks as well. So that is kind of leading us up to today. That's where we are now, is with this mishmash of technologies. By the way, if we all, by we, I mean like the carriers, if all the carriers adopted LTE, if they rolled out robust LTE networks and phased out the older networks, then you could, in theory, have a phone that could work on any network as long as it was an LTE phone, because it's no longer this branching technology where you've got the GSM versus CDMA. It would all be unified. In theory, in practice, not going to happen, because you've got companies putting in proprietary software that is required to run in order for you to do something like make a voice call. So you can't just take the phone you have on one network and pop onto another network and not have any problems.
It's overall advantageous, I would say, for humanity, for everyone to be working within the same infrastructure.
Yeah.
But it's honestly very advantageous from a business perspective to use your own proprietary stuff.
Yeah, to lock
stuff.
You in. Yeah.
You can sell more stuff. Yay.
Yeah.
I love being locked in. It's so cozy.
Right.
It's like a hobbit hole that you can't leave.
When I don't have to make choices, my life is so much easier.
Actually, there is some truth to that. We should talk about the science of choice sometime.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah, if you have, unlimited choice, then you could be paralyzed by it. We've talked about that a couple times on Tech Stuff.
Yes, yes. Okay, but so shade aside.
Yes.
Let's look forward to this amazing future of 5G.
Okay.
Right. Well, what inspired us to talk about this today was, again, like I said, an article that I read about people predicting 5G, what the next generation of this wireless technology would be. So 5G is not a fixed standard yet.
Right.
It's more of a kind of an ambiguous concept. What's going on now is people are debating and talking about what 5G is going to be.
Yeah, they're kind of blue skying it. I mean, you can make certain predictions saying like these are the sort of things we would consider necessary for us to call it 5G. For example, we would expect even faster data rates. That would be an expectation of the advancement of the generations of this technology. But there are other elements as well. So it's one of those things, again, since we don't have a hard and fast number, ultimately what might happen is the next technology that comes out, people will start calling 5G, and it may not come close to measuring up to some of the things that people have proposed.
Right, but already there have been some like politicians and industry leaders trying to set really ambitious goals for what should be done.
Incredibly ambitious.
Yeah.
Like sometimes like you hear it and you think, wait, what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the topic of 5G was addressed in March 2015 at the 2015 Mobile World Congress, and Bonnie Cha for Recode put together a good write-up afterwards, including predictions made about speed, which came to – the prediction was that 5G would feature ideal speeds of 10 gigabits per second.
Gigabits.
And I just thought WT – some other letter.
WTG.
Are they, yeah.
What the G?
What the generation?
Are they for real? Because, so the 4G, Cha points out that the 4G standard, the ideal standard, is 1 gigabit per second, but
yeah,
it's never actually that fast, is it?
No.
I mean, no. And what prevents it from operating at that top speed?
Well, there's just the basic limitation of the systems themselves. Like I said, with LTE, the regular LTE, you top out at around 300 megabits per second, even under ideal circumstances.
But what goes into that speed is a whole bunch of factors.
Yeah.
It's going to be the distance between you and the tower that your device is communicating with. It's mm-hmm. going to be the amount of other data that tower is handling at the mm-hmm. time. The weather, the number of trees that are between you and the tower.
Yeah, yeah. It's tons of stuff like that. Now, if you are talking about, you know, lab conditions, then that's where you would probably get this ideal speed. But even in those lab conditions, no one has come close to the gigabits per second. Although LTE Advanced has the theoretical peak performance of 3 gigabits per second download speed, 1.5 gigabits per second upload speed. But as I said earlier, there are not very many LTE advanced networks rolled out yet. So we don't have a lot of real world testing in that realm.
Yeah, I should have added to that list to the physical capacity, the physical technological capacity of both your device and
yes.
all of the computers at the other end of the network that it's talking to.
Yeah, it's kind of like saying that, you know, if you have a hallway that's 10 people wide, but your doorway is only one person wide,
mm-hmm.
then, and you think of the doorway being your device, then your device would be the bottleneck in that case.
Or, yeah. Or even, you know, like, I've got this really elegant software and a tricycle.
Yeah. Yeah. That would not be helpful.
Y'all at home should have seen Lauren gesturing. She was pointing at the tricycle.
I believed there was a tricycle there.
No.
That's how convincing it was.
Maybe 10 gigabits per second, which, again, was the prediction here. Maybe that's not meaningful to you. So think about it like this.
Okay,
it is 1.25 gigabytes per second.
Yeah.
So that would
mean
you could, like, if you wanted to download a video game, you could download a copy of Skyrim in, like, 5 seconds.
Or what about like a movie?
Well, so like a 1080p HD movie in compressed format would maybe take also like about 5 seconds or less.
Wow.
The computer I used in college, you could download its entire hard drive in less than 3 seconds.
And if you want another illustration of how fast this is, so 10 gigabits per second, that's 10 times faster than the speeds promised by Google Fiber and competing carriers.
The wired connection.
Yeah.
Oh, right, right.
Actual optical cable going to your house. You know, often, like Lauren and I are both video gamers. Joe, you play some video games too.
Some, yeah.
So we all are aware of the idea that if you're playing an online game, it's better to have that wired connection than it is to go with wireless, because you can have lag and latency and all these other issues.
Oh, sure. Anytime that you add that extra step of having to beam the signal from your router
to
your actual device.
Yeah.
You're
so
slowing it down.
It's better to have that physical dedicated line. And that's what I would think, too, until I hear 10 gigabits per second wireless transmission. Oof. Because it's 10 times faster than the optical fiber.
I mean, that would make you wonder, like, okay, so why would we even have optical fiber? What's the point of wires at that point?
Yeah.
There isn't one.
Right. Oops. If you could actually get to that point, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, I'm sure, later. If you could get to a point where 10 gigabits per second Even if that's the ideal and you never reach the ideal.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Let's say it's, you know, the real speed you get is 4 gigabits
it's
per second.
Still 4 times faster than fiber is.
Yeah.
Right? And even then, when you say 1 gigabit per second with Google Fiber, that's the ideal for Google Fiber. You might top out at 900 megabits per second. That's not acceptable.
So,
you're going to get 4 gigabits per second over the air.
You mentioned the difference between lab conditions and real conditions.
Yeah.
In ideal conditions, what kind of things can we do now at the top end of speed?
So with the 5G technology in the lab right now, the average speed tends to be around 1 gigabit per second, which, if you remember, is the promised speed of 4G. So
right.
It feels like we're just playing catch up. But there have been some demos of much faster speeds. Samsung held a demo where they showed that they could hit 7.5 gigabits per second when it was stationary and 1.2 gigabits per second if the device was traveling at a speed of 100 kilometers per hour or 62 miles per hour. Pretty impressive. So at that speed, I mean, you could end up being able to stream content without any problems. There's a ton of stuff that you would be able to access. And, you know, we're talking a lot about mobile devices, but honestly, this technology is working its way into a lot of other platforms, including cars. So there are a lot of potential uses, and we'll talk a bit about those in a moment or two.
Yeah. So another predicted standard of 5G would be very, very low latency,
mm-hmm.
like 1 millisecond latency. And mm-hmm. if you ask what is latency, that's just the time of delay in delivering a packet from one device to another. So a packet's a piece of data. The amount of data you can transmit in a certain period of time might change. You might have more bandwidth or throughput. But the latency is just the time lag in delivering one packet.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing would be connectedness.
Mm-hmm.
How much can a network support? Like, how many things can you wirelessly send data between at the same time?
Yeah, and this was a real concern, especially earlier in cellular networks where you would have towers that would get overwhelmed. And
yeah, by like 3 signals at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the old days, there were, you would look and you'd say like, all right, this one city has a broadcast tower and it can handle like 2 simultaneous connections, mm-hmm. and that's it. You know, obviously that technology has improved over time.
And that is largely a software issue. I mean, also a memory issue, but what you're really talking about is the capacity of a computer to multitask.
Yeah, essentially that's what it boils down to. And that has improved significantly over time, and it would have to, because we're also talking about the burgeoning era of the Internet of Things when we're adding lots more devices to various networks.
Yeah, so there it's not just your cell phone or not just your computer, your tablet. It's also all the devices in your house and your car and probably a bunch of sensors outside mm-hmm. taking data on various stuff.
Yeah, now you could have these things connecting into their own network, which then connects to an access point, right?
Right.
Like, so you could have essentially a traffic manager in the form of a router
mm-hmm.
that would take care of some of that. But it's also potential if you have the capacity to handle billions of different devices at a time on a single tower, you could have them connecting directly to the network and not have to have a router. I don't know that you would necessarily want to do that because you might want the router in order to do some traffic management on your end or to control access to things. Obviously, direct access to devices could pose a security risk as well.
There are probably lots of considerations to take there.
Yeah.
Another consideration for the system as a whole is going to be the management of all of those
elements,
really the management of the data flow, I suppose.
Yeah, so this was really interesting to me. We've talked a lot about the other elements of 5G. One of the proposed ones, and keep in mind, again, this is an ongoing discussion. So some of these things we're talking about may become a reality in whatever does become 5G, and some mm-hmm. of them maybe don't become a reality. But one of the things that was mentioned at a conference, Ericsson CEO Hans Vestberg said that the 5G network should be able to respond in real time to the various demands of devices that were on the network and be able to facilitate those devices so it delivers the best experience for whatever that device might be and whatever the use case might be. So, for example, if you have a mobile device and you're streaming a movie in HD, you would need to have that fast download rate to accommodate that huge amount of data that's streaming to your device. So the network would accommodate you and say, all right, we're going to give this data rate to that device because that's how much it needs in order to do the thing that they've asked. Let's say, though, that you have a driverless car that connects back to the network. Then you want extremely low latency because safety depends upon it. You can't have a lag between the detection of something like a potential obstacle and its response.
I mean, that's tragic when it happens in Halo, but it's real tragic when it happens on a road.
Exactly. So this would be a case where you would need to have the least amount of latency possible. It also opens up the possibility of something we've talked about before. Remember when we started talking about the early ideas of the autonomous car involved a system that cars would navigate through. And the cars would just be one part of the system, and how we have seen cars evolve so that they're more independent, right?
Yeah.
They don't tend to work within a network. They're independent and they have all the systems self-enclosed in the car. This is kind of shifting back to the possibility of having a big, interdependent system, mm-hmm. which could have benefits over a bunch of independent vehicles. But we talked about that extensively in our autonomous car episode, so I won't go back over it. Or you could have even the ability for the network to sense when a gadget's battery is running low. So let's say that you've been using your phone all day and you're not home yet. You want your phone to last a little longer, and your phone is aware that the battery is down to like 15%. So now the network is aware that your phone's battery is down to 15%, and it starts to ping your phone less frequently to make sure that your phone is still connected. And because it's pinging it less frequently, sending it updates less frequently, your phone is just sipping at that battery power instead of gulping it down, and it extends the battery life of your device, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Other considerations would have to include cooperation with previous networks.
Yeah.
Because part of what 5G would have to do to be successful is leave room for older devices that are only capable of connecting through 3 or 4G.
Yeah, that's a big issue, right? Is you have to continue to support legacy devices. Mm-hmm.
That backwards compatibility issue, right?
Yeah, because not everyone is able to... First of all, you never know when a system is going to fail and you need the backup systems there.
Sure.
Secondly, you never know when a system is going to get overwhelmed. Like when I go to CES, I will often switch my phone so that it uses a 3G network and doesn't even look for 4G because it helps save me time and effort and frustration.
Battery,
exactly. And also, not everyone can upgrade at the same time, right? Like if we all were magically given 5G phones as soon as it came out, it'd be awesome. And we'd say, oh, we don't need these other things. But that's not the way the world works. I probably won't get a 5G phone until 6G comes out.
You know, another thing about this next generation in quotes, is that people are talking about using different radio bandwidths, these high frequency bandwidths that could transmit a lot more data, right?
Sure.
But they would also have drawbacks too, right?
Yeah.
The more data can only be transferred across shorter distances due to the physical properties of these particular high frequency radio waves.
Right. Which means you would need a lot more
towers and base stations and all of that, and better antenna technology would have to be another development here.
Yeah, because I mean that becomes sort of a social barrier, not a technological barrier in a way, because then you've got people saying, I really don't want a cell phone tower erected in my neighborhood, right? I don't want that here. Or
even, you know, the possibility of like cellular deserts, the way that we have some nutritional deserts in large areas.
Yeah. So you could have really underserved areas. So you might have some parts that are just swimming in gigabits. And other bits where other areas where, you know, you just that service just immediately drops out. And until you get to another densely populated area, you don't get that service.
You cross the county line and you can't stream Blu-rays constantly.
Well, what's the timeline we're looking at here? You know, we're talking a lot about the future. How far into the future are we talking about?
Well, two companies have talked about setting up temporary 5G networks as soon as 2018. Samsung for the 2018 Winter Olympics in South Korea, and Huawei, is that how you say that?
I'm gonna say yes because I am either that or Huawei. That sounds too much like it came from Anchorman.
Yes,
I'm
that one.
Go with yours.
For the World Cup in Moscow the same year. Both of those goals, I think, are ridiculously ambitious.
Yeah.
It's really hard to say for sure how this technology is going to develop over the next few years. 2020 is the date that I've seen floated for commercial availability, and I know that Japan is hoping to have a permanent network available for the 2020 Summer Olympics. But amazing things can happen. Maybe that could happen, but even if it does, I would guess that it's going to be a much longer period of time before 5G completely overtakes the prior networks.
Right, and even in 2018, even if they build out the network, you still have to have the technology to actually take advantage of that. So I imagine that technology will largely be limited to things like broadcast stations that happen to have the capability of having commercial level technology that can tap in. Because, if it's a temporary thing that's up for the Olympics, how do they sell that to consumers? Hey, this phone's going to be really fast for like 2 weeks. And then it's going to be not so fast because we're shutting down the network.
Yeah. I'm sure that it's some kind of like promotional thing. Samsung, like especially a creator like Samsung, who also has a hardware side of the business.
Yeah.
Would use that as a promotional opportunity to give journalists their fancy cell phones or
give everybody 5G burner phones.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I watched so much Netflix in such a short amount of time. So let's talk about how this stuff could really change our lives. We mentioned it a little bit with the idea of this being faster than fiber connections.
Yeah.
It potentially could be way faster than fiber connections, assuming that a statistic we read was not in fact a typo, which is still hard for me to believe.
So the head of a tech development project called the Innovation Center, which is out of the University of Surrey, a person by the name of Rahim Tafazoli.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't look up any of these things. I'm usually so good at looking things up before I come into the studio. I apologize if I just butchered your name, human person. told the BBC that he thinks that 5G could lend itself to 800 gigabits per second.
What?
You need to put that in a phrase that I'm going to be able to comprehend.
That's like downloading 33 HD movies per second.
33 HD movies per second.
Per second.
Or like 3 Peter Jackson movies in a second.
Well, yeah.
And, a lot of people, like my first reaction to this is always like, what would I ever need with that speed? But I've said that throughout my entire life and I've managed to take advantage of it. And
I said
that the first time I looked at a 3.25-inch floppy disk.
Yeah.
Is one of those principles in computing is that where capability emerges, people will find ways to use it.
Well, and with the emerging technologies of 4K and 8K resolution coming out, you could easily see this being a way of getting access to that kind of content so that you get this ultra high definition experience delivered over something that doesn't have a bottleneck to it. Now, obviously, 4K and 8K are also going to rely very heavily on sophisticated compression algorithms because otherwise the rest of us would never be able to see it. But if you have the ability to throughput 800 gigabits per second, compression is not necessarily your number one concern. Yeah, maybe overtaking your data plan in like 37 minutes would be your major concern.
Data plans. What would they even look like? That's crazy. I mean, a lot of the potential for this, one of the easiest and most obvious things to point out is the potential for streaming media, like we've been saying, streaming high definition movies and stuff. One of the things I thought is how it could change what could be done with like cloud computing and cloud gaming, for example. So wouldn't this make cloud gaming basically unstoppable? Because why would you shell out for like a workhorse console like a PS4 or an Xbox One or something that has strong hardware and computing power when really all you need is an internet-connected display and a controller of some kind?
Well, yeah, especially if you can have a really working service, and we've seen services that try and take this model, succeeding to various degrees or not succeeding to various degrees. But if you had this ability to transmit that much data that quickly, it would remove a lot of the barriers people have seen, especially things like latency and lag. It would potentially remove those concerns so that you could have a really satisfying gaming experience without having to have that console in your home. And it sends this, creates this ability for you to have a service run where the service provider can make the investment to improve hardware as hardware advances come along. And then, you know, because of the massive amount of revenue generated on a subscription service or even a pay to play per game service, it's not a concern. Whereas if I'm a PC gamer, one of the big barriers to entry is just the investment to get a good, like a really good gaming rig.
Yeah.
And then to keep it in really good shape, because knowing that in 6 months to a year, a lot of my equipment is going to go from good to passable. And then in another 6 months to a year, it's going to go from passable to not acceptable, which means I constantly need to be upgrading my system. This way, all the upgrades happen on the back end, not on your console. Now, it might also mean that your subscription fee goes up, but
yeah. Well, I mean, wouldn't you always need a system capable of parsing that 800 gigabits per second?
You would definitely need to have
turning
something
it into
meaningful
yeah. visual information.
Yeah.
But
yeah, depending on how it would depend on how your cloud gaming runs. If you're just doing the sort of like streaming media model, I mean, there what's happening is that the game is running entirely on the server.
Right.
And it's the data it's taking from you is what buttons you're pushing.
Right.
And the data it's giving to you is visual and auditory. It's essentially as if you're watching a movie.
Yeah, it just has to be. So the point you're making is a valid one, Lauren. The device would have to be capable of accepting whatever that minimum amount of information is for that game system to work properly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had a bottleneck there, then obviously you would have to upgrade whatever, like your smart TV or whatever it might be. Maybe it's like a little dumb set-top box that connects to your TV that just accepts the information and sends the signals to the TV. But even that would have to have the capacity to accept this massive amount of information. Yeah, like we were saying before, there are two sides of this, right? There's the system, the back-end side, and then there's the consumer side, the device. And having something capable of delivering huge amounts of data and having something capable of accepting huge amount of data are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you got to have both of them.
Otherwise, it's a really one-sided conversation.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. You're like, my phone could download this movie in like 0.5 seconds if it wasn't
If anyone was sending me that beautiful movie, no one wants to.
Yeah.
Another big implication of 5G, of course, is going to be for the Internet of Things, as we said earlier, connecting more devices.
Right, right. And yeah, you were talking about that earlier because, you know, right now a lot of people have more than one wireless device. But by 2020, if, you know, your fridge and your air conditioning and your coffee pot and your car and your stoplights and your storm drains and whatever else are all connected to the web, people are predicting that there could be 50 to 100 billion connected devices worldwide.
So you got to have some means of being able to facilitate that huge number of connections.
Yeah. Like we are going to need this more powerful generation of wireless connectivity if that future is going to be possible.
Right. Otherwise, you know, you might be cursing the fact that your neighbor's got a smart kitchen outfitted in their home because now you can't get a decent phone signal.
Yeah, and also like we were talking about, those self-driving cars would be of particular benefit to the system because, you know, having faster and less clogged communication across the network would allow for smoother route mapping and better traffic control and that emergency response that we were talking about earlier where, you know, if an accident does happen, then every car on the road could be told to brake, preventing a pileup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are all incredible applications of this technology or potential applications. So I'm excited.
One more is remote activities. So, you know, imagine the best surgeon for your personal needs being able to not only teleconsult with you from anywhere in the world, but also being able to operate a robotic surgical tool from anywhere.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the big problems with telesurgery has been the latency problem.
Yeah. There have been some examples of telesurgery that have been kind of a scary proof of concept, you know, like people proving that this is a possible thing, but they were using very dedicated lines for a predetermined specific purpose. This would potentially open up the opportunity of using it on a more regular basis instead of it being this, like, we're proving that this is possible. This would make it practical, or at least a potential practical solution to what could otherwise be a life-threatening problem. So, yeah, I mean, these are all great examples of how 5G could end up being a huge benefit to us, assuming that it all works out. I mean, we're still talking about something that's still in the kind of brainstorming phase.
Yeah, I guess one of the main questions is just how realistic is this? I mean, we're looking at these extremely crazy, optimistic predictions.
Yeah.
And personally, I don't really know what to make of it. I mean, I guess I don't know enough about cellular and wireless technology to know what's actually plausible and what's just sort of, you know, people setting ambitious goals.
Well, and if you were able to actually roll this out, I mean, there's going to be a lot of investment that's going to be necessary to make this a reality, where the carriers will have to invest in upgrading their infrastructure. So in other words, either building new towers or adding antenna to existing towers, whatever, however that might turn out. And so it's not like everyone's going to get it at the same time. It'll be like all the other networks rolled out, where some networks got access to 3G and 4G speeds well before other ones did. So we're going to probably see that again. So that's going to take some time. But once that does happen, and once 5G becomes more widely adopted, the question I have is, what happens to all the wired infrastructure? Like, do we keep it? I mean, it would make sense to keep it as a backup anyway, in case something happens to the wireless network. But at the same time, if you're talking about having wireless transmission rates that dwarf, you know, wired rates to the point where it's a factor of 10 or more, then you start to question, why do we even have these, like, wires up? Should we take them down?
Will it become like the wired telephone in your house, where you're like, oh, don't answer any email from the wired internet connection? We just know that's spam.
Yeah. I mean, it's a interesting question. I expect that we will have, for a long time, we'll have all of these various infrastructures running concurrently, because again, not everyone's going to magically get upgraded and be able to take advantage of this kind of stuff. So it's going to be one of those things that if it's a transition, it'll be a gradual transition. Maybe we're talking 10 or 20 years down the road before enough people have gotten off the legacy systems for those to be shut down. I mean, sometimes you just have to pull the plug and you just say, listen, at X date, this change is going to happen. Here are some programs to help you get caught up if you are left behind, but we still have to do this because it only makes sense for us to concentrate on these existing infrastructures and not continue to support something that is technically obsolete.
Oh, sure.
Okay, will I still be able to use all those promotional CDs I got for AOL and Prodigy back in the day?
If you had said CompuServe, I would have had good news for you, Joe. But sadly, I'm going to leave that question unanswered.
Yes. One more thing before we leave real quick, though. And I do want to mention that all of this also ties into the infrastructural use of airwaves, of radio waves.
Yeah.
And what the future holds for various forms of communication will have an impact on all of these systems that we're trying to create.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we have to make space available for this stuff. And the question is, do we take it away from something else? Do we just go with the small gaps that still exist between certain bandwidths? You know, there's certain bandwidths that stop being used and the FCC started auctioning them off here in the United States. Is that potentially a use for this kind of technology? There are a lot of questions that we don't have the answers to, like practical questions. And some of them are going to have some tough answers, because eventually we're going to get to a point where we said, all right, we've used all the frequencies that we can expect to usefully deliver data, right? Beyond this, we can't really – either the data transmission is going to be so low or the distance is going to be so short that it's not a practical use anymore. At that point, we have to start saying, all right, what do we get rid of so that we can have this new shiny thing? That's going to be tough.
Maybe that's an excuse not to connect our toasters to the internet.
Maybe. Maybe. You know, we can't let fear dictate our pathway to the future. And gosh darn it, I want internet-connected toast. All right, so guys, if you have any suggestions for future topics that we can talk about here on Forward Thinking, maybe there's something you've always wondered about, like how is that going to work in the future, or you just have questions or comments about stuff we've said, get in touch with us. Send us an email. The address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or you can drop us a line on Twitter, Google Plus, or Facebook. At Twitter and Google Plus, we are FW Thinking. And on Facebook, just search FW Thinking. We'll pop right up, leave us a message, and we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.